Chapter 2. The small operating room was lighted bright as day. It looked like a very hygienic slaughterhouse. Pails with blood-drenched cotton stood here and there, bandages and tampons lay scattered, and the red was a loud and solemn protest against all the white. Weber was sitting at an enameled steel table in the anteroom, making notes. A nurse was boiling the instruments, the water bubbled, the light seemed to hum, and only the body on the table lay quite independent. Nothing any longer mattered to it. Ravitch let the liquid soap run over his hands and began to wash. He did it with a furious sullenness, as if he wished to rub off his skin. "Damn," he muttered. "Damned confounded crap." The nurse looked at him with disgust. Weber glanced up.
"Calm down, Nurse Eugenie. All surgeons swear, particularly if something has gone wrong. You should be used to it."
The nurse threw a handful of instruments into the boiling water.
"Professor Perrier never swore," she explained in an offended tone.
"Professor Perrier was a brain specialist, a most subtle mechanic, Eugenie. We work in the abdomen, that's something else."
Weber closed his notebook and got up.
"You did your best, Ravitch. But after all, one can't win against quacks."
"Oh, yes. Sometimes you can."
Ravitch dried his hands and lit a cigarette. The nurse opened the window in silent disapproval.
"Bravo, Eugenie," Weber praised her. "Always according to rules."
"I have responsibilities. I don't want to be blown up."
"That's nice, Eugenie, and reassuring."
"Some have none, and some don't want to have any."
"That's meant for you, Ravitch," Weber laughed. "We'd better disappear. Eugenie is always aggressive in the morning. Anyway, there's nothing to be done here."
Ravitch turned around. He looked at the dutiful nurse. She returned his look fearlessly. The steel-rimmed glasses made her bleak face somehow untouchable. She was a human being like himself, but to him she appeared more alien than a tree.
"Pardon me," he said. "You are right, nurse."
Under the white light on the table lay what a few hours before had been hope, breath, pain, and quivering life. Now it was only an insensible cadaver, and the human automaton called Nurse Eugenie, with responsibilities and respect for herself, proud of never having taken a false step, covered it up and rolled it away. "These are the ones who live forever," Ravitch thought. "Life does not love them, these souls of wood. Therefore it forgets them and lets them live on and on."
"So long, nurse," Weber said. "Take a good sleep today."
"Goodbye, Dr. Weber." "Thank you, doctor."
"Goodbye," Ravitch said. "Excuse my swearing."
"Good morning,"
Eugenie replied icily.
Weber smiled. "A character of cast iron."
Outside, a grey day was dawning. Garbage trucks rattled through the streets. Weber turned up his collar.
"Nasty weather. Can I give you a lift, Ravitch?"
"No, thanks. I'd rather walk."
"In this weather? I can drop you. It's not out of my way."
Ravitch shook his head.
"Thank you, Weber."
Weber gave him an appraising look.
"Strange that you still get worked up when someone dies under the knife. Haven't you been at it for the last 15 years? You should be used to it by now."
"Yes, I am. And I'm not worked up."
Weber stood before Ravitch, broad and heavy. His big, round face shone like a Normandy apple. His black, trimmed moustache, wet with rain, glittered. The Buick standing at the curb also glittered. Presently Weber would drive home comfortably in it to a rose-coloured doll's house in the suburbs, with a neat, glittering woman in it, and two neat, glittering children, and a neat, glittering life. How could one explain to him something of that breathless tension when the knife began the first cut and the narrow red trace followed the light pressure, when the body, under clips and forceps, opened up like a multiple curtain, when organs which had never seen the light were laid bare, when one followed a track like a hunter in a jungle and suddenly faced the huge wild beast, death, in destroyed tissues, in lumps, in tumours, in scissors, and the fight began, the silent, mad fight during which one could use no other weapon than a thin blade and a needle and a steady hand? How could one explain what it meant when then, all at once, a dark shadow rushed through the blinding white of stark concentration, a majestic derision that seemed to render the knife dull, the needle brittle, and the hand heavy? And when this invisible, enigmatic pulsing life then ebbed away under one's powerless hands, collapsed, drawn into this ghostly vortex which one could never reach or hold, and when a face that had a moment ago breathed and borne a name turned into a rigid, nameless mask, this senseless, rebellious helplessness, how could one explain it? And what was there to explain? Ravitch lit another cigarette. 21 years old, he said. With his handkerchief, Weber wiped the shiny drops from his moustache.
"You worked marvellously, Ravitch. I couldn't have done it. That you couldn't save what a quack had botched up is something that does not concern you. Where would we be if we thought otherwise?"
"Yes," Ravitch said. "Where would we be?" Weber put his handkerchief back. "After all you have gone through, you should be damn tough by now." Ravitch looked at him with a trace of irony. "One is never tough. But one can get used to a lot of things."
"But that's what I mean."
"Yes, and to some things never, but that is difficult to realize. Let's take for granted that it was the coffee. Maybe it actually was the coffee that made me so edgy, and we confuse it with excitement.
Coffee was good, wasn't it?"
"Very good. Now I know how to make coffee. I had an idea you'd need it, that's why I made it myself. It was different from the black water Eugenie usually produces, wasn't it?"
"No comparison. You're a master at making coffee."
Weber stepped into his car. He trod on the starter and leaned out of the window.
"Couldn't I drop you? You must be tired."
"Like a seal," Ravitch thought absent-mindedly. "He is like a healthy seal. But what does that mean? Why does it occur to me? Why always these double thoughts?"
"I'm no longer tired," he said. "The coffee woke me up. Sleep well, Weber."
Weber laughed. His teeth glistened beneath his black moustache.
"I won't go to bed now. I'll work in my garden. I'll plant tulips and daffodils."
Tulips and daffodils, Ravitch thought, in neat separate beds with neat gravelled paths between. Tulips and daffodils, the peach-coloured golden storm of spring.
"So long, Weber," he said. "You will take care of the rest, won't you?"
"Naturally. I'll call you up in the evening. Sorry the fee will be low, not even worth mentioning. The girl was poor and, as it seems, had no relatives. We'll see about that."
Ravitch dismissed it with a gesture. "She gave 100 francs to Eugenie. Apparently that was all she had. That will be 25 francs for you."
"Never mind," Ravitch said impatiently. "So long, Weber."
"So long. Till tomorrow morning at 8.
Ravitch walked slowly along the Rue Lauriston. Had it been summer, he would have sat down on a bench in the Bois in the morning sun, and, with vacant mind, would have stared into the water and the young woods until the tension left him. Then he would have driven to the hotel and gone to bed. He entered a bistro at the corner of the Rue Boissière. A few workers and truck drivers stood at the bar. They drank hot, black coffee, dipping brioche into it. Ravitch watched them for a time. This was ordinary, simple life, a life to seize hold of, to work with. Tiredness in the evening, eating, a woman, and a heavy, dreamless sleep.
"A kirsch," he said.
The dying girl had worn a cheap, narrow chain of imitation gold around her right ankle, one of those little follies that are possible only when one is young, sentimental, and without taste. A chain with a little plate and an inscription, "Toujours Charles," riveted around her ankle so that one could not take it off. A chain that told a story of Sundays in the woods near the Seine, of being in love and of ignorant youth, of a small jeweller somewhere in Neuilly, of nights in September in an attic, and then suddenly the staying away, the waiting, the fear, "Toujours Charles," who never showed up again. Then the girlfriend who knew an address, the midwife somewhere, a table covered with oilcloth, piercing pain and blood. Blood, a bewildered old woman's face, arms pushing you quickly into a cab to be rid of you, days of misery and of hiding, and finally the ride to the hospital, the last 100 francs crumpled in the hot, moist hand. Too late. The radio began to blare, a tango, to which a nasal voice sang idiotic words. Ravitch caught himself performing the whole operation over again. He checked every move. Maybe, some hours earlier, there might have been a chance. Weber had had him called. He had not been in the hotel. So the girl had to die because he had been loafing on the Pont de l'Alma. Weber could not perform such operations himself. The idiocy of chance. The foot with the golden chain limp turned inward. "Come into my boat, the moon is shining," the crooner quavered in falsetto. Ravitch paid and left. Outside he stopped a taxi.
"A drive to the Osiris."
The Osiris was a large middle-class brothel with a huge bar in Egyptian style.
"We're just closing," the doorman said. "There is no one inside."
"No one?"
"Only Madame Roland. The ladies have all gone."
"All right." The doorman ill-humouredly stamped on the pavement with his galoshes.
"Why don't you keep the taxi? It won't be easy to get another one later. We're closed." "You said that once before." "I'll get another taxi, all right."
Ravitch put a package of cigarettes into the doorman's breast pocket and walked through the small door past the cloakroom into the big room. The bar was empty. It gave the usual impression of the remains of a bourgeois symposium, pools of spilled wine, a couple of overturned chairs, butts on the floor, and the smell of tobacco, sweet perfume, and flesh.
"Roland," Ravitch said.
She stood in front of a table on which was a pile of pink silk underwear.
"Ravitch," she said without surprise. "Late. What do you want, a girl or something to drink, or both?"
"Vodka. The Polish."
Roland brought the bottle and a glass.
"Help yourself. I still have to sort and list the laundry. The laundry wagon will be here any minute. If one doesn't keep track of everything, that gang will steal like a flock of magpies. The drivers, you understand, as presents for their girls."
Ravitch nodded.
"Turn the music on, Roland. Loud."
"All right."
Roland put the plug in. The sound of drums and brass went thundering through the high, empty room like a storm.
"Too loud, Ravitch?"
"No."
"Too loud? What was too loud? Only the quiet. The quiet in which one burst as though in a vacuum."
"All through."
Roland came to Ravitch's table. She had a buxom figure, a clear face, and calm black eyes. The black Puritan dress she wore characterized her as the gouvernante. It distinguished her from the almost naked whores.
"Have a drink with me, Roland."
"All right."
Ravitch fetched a glass from the bar and poured. Roland pulled the bottle back when her glass was half filled.
"Enough. I won't drink more."
"Half-filled glasses are disgusting. Leave what you don't drink."
"Why? That would be wasteful."
Ravitch glanced up. He saw the reliable, intelligent face and smiled.
"Waste. The old French fear. Why save? You're not saved from anything."
"This is business. That's something else."
Ravitch laughed.
"Let's drink a toast to it. What would the world be without business ethics? A pack of criminals, idealists, and sluggards."
"You need a girl," Roland said. "I can call up Kiki. She is very good, 21 years old."
"So, 21 years too. That's not for me today."
Ravitch refilled his glass.
"What do you actually think of, Roland, before you fall asleep?"
"Mostly of nothing. I am too tired."
"And when you aren't tired?"
"Of Tours."
"Why?"
"An aunt of mine owns a house with a shop there. I hold 2 mortgages on it. When she dies, she is 76, I'll get the house. Then I'll make a cafe out of the shop, light wallpaper with flower designs, a band, 3 men, piano, violin, cello, in the rear, a bar. Small and fine. The house is situated in a good district. I think I'll be able to furnish it for 9,500 francs, even with curtains and lamps. Then I'll put aside another 5,000 for the first few months, and naturally I'll have the rent from the first and second floors. That's what I think about."
"Were you born in Tours?"
"Yes. But no one knows where I've been since. And if the business prospers, no one will bother about it either. Money covers everything."
"Not everything, but a lot."
Ravitch felt the heaviness behind his eyes that slowed down his voice.
"I think I have had enough," he said, and took a few bills out of his pocket. "Will you marry in Tours, Roland?"
"Well, not right away, but in a few years. I have a friend there."
"Do you go there occasionally?"
"Rarely. He writes sometimes.
to another address, of course. He's married, but his wife is in the hospital. Tuberculosis. 1 or 2 more years at the most, the doctors say. Then he'll be free.
Ravitch got up. God bless you, Roland. You have sound common sense.
She smiled appreciatively. She believed he was right. Her clear face showed not a trace of tiredness. It was as fresh as if she had just got up from sleep. She knew what she wanted. Life held no secrets for her. Outside it had become bright day. The rain had stopped. The pissoirs stood like armoured turrets at the street corners. The doorman had disappeared. The night was wiped out. The day had begun, and a bustling crowd thronged the entrances to the subway, as if they were holes into which they flung themselves as sacrifice to some dark deity. The woman started up from the sofa. She did not cry out. She just started up with a low, suppressed sound, propped herself on her elbows, and stiffened.
"Quiet, quiet," Ravitch said. "It's me, the man who brought you here a few hours ago."
The woman breathed again. Ravitch saw her only indistinctly. The glow of the electric bulbs blended with the morning creeping through the windows in a yellowish, pale, sickly light.
"I think we can turn these off now," he said, and turned the switch.
He felt again the soft hammers of drunkenness behind his forehead.
"Do you want breakfast?" he asked.
He had forgotten the woman, and then when he got his key he had believed she had left. He would have liked to be rid of her. He had drunk enough, the backdrop of his consciousness had shifted, the clanging chain of time had burst asunder, and memories and dreams stood around him, strong and fearless. He wanted to be alone.
"Do you want some coffee?" he asked. "It's the only thing that's any good here."
The woman shook her head. He looked more closely at her.
"What's the matter? Has anybody been here?"
No.
"But something must be the matter. You stare at me as if I were a ghost."
The woman moved her lips.
"The smell," she said.
"Smell?" Ravitch repeated uncomprehendingly. "Well, vodka hardly smells, neither does kirsch or cognac. And cigarettes you smoke yourself. What's there about that to be scared of?"
"I don't mean that."
"What is it then, for God's sake?"
"It is the same smell."
"Oh, heavens, it must be ether," said Ravitch, suddenly understanding. "Is it ether?"
She nodded.
"Have you ever been operated on?"
"No, it is—"
Ravitch did not listen further. He opened the window.
"It will be gone in a minute. Smoke a cigarette meanwhile."
He went into the bathroom and turned on the faucets. He saw his face in the mirror. A few hours ago he had stood here in the same way. In the interim a human being had died. It did not matter. Thousands of people died every moment. There were statistics about it. It did not matter. For the one individual, however, it meant everything and was more important than the still revolving world. He sat down on the edge of the tub and took off his shoes. That always stayed the same. Objects and their silent compulsion. The triviality, the stale habit in all the delusive lights of passing experience. The flowering shore of the heart by the waters of love. But whatever one was, poet, demigod, or idiot, every few hours one was called down from his heavens to urinate.
One could not escape it. The irony of nature.
The romantic rainbow over gland reflexes and bowel movements. The organs of ecstasy at the same time diabolically arranged for excretion. Ravitch flung his shoes into a corner. Detestable habit of undressing. Not even this could one escape. Only one who lived alone understood it. There was a sort of damnable resignation, of yielding, in it. He had often slept in his clothes to get away from it. But it was only a postponement. One could not escape it. He turned on the shower. The cool water streamed over his skin. He drew a deep breath and dried himself. The comfort of small things. Water. Breath. Evening rain. They, too, were things that only one who lived alone could understand. Grateful skin. More freely circling blood in the dark channels. To lie down in a meadow. Birches. Summer clouds. The sky of youth. What has become of the adventures of the heart? Killed by the dark adventures of existence. He returned to the room. The woman was crouching in a corner of the sofa, the blanket drawn high about her.
"Are you cold?" he asked. She shook her head. "Scared?" she nodded. "Of me?"
"No."
"Of the outside?"
"Yes."
Ravitch closed the window.
"Thank you,"
she said. He looked at the nape of her neck in front of him. Shoulders. Something that breathed. A fragment of strange life, but life. Warmth. No stiffening body. What could one give another but a little warmth? And what was more? The woman moved. She trembled. She looked at Ravitch. He felt the wave receding. A deep coolness came, without heaviness. The tension was over. Space opened before him. It was as though he had returned after a night on another planet. Suddenly everything was simple. The morning, the woman. There was nothing more to think.
"Come," he said. She stared at him. "Come," he said impatiently.